Hi, and welcome to On the Steps of 36, a podcast by AirAA at the Architectural Association. Today, we're joined by George Massoud, an architect, educator, and cultural worker. He is the director of Material Cultures, a design and research practice based in London. George wants to build futures in solidarity with the various ecologies that shape our built environment, which he explores through the spaces he occupies as a practitioner, in the studio, in the classroom, and in the community. So, welcome, George. It's great to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Manice.
So can you please state your full name and also tell us your star sign?
My full name is George Massoud. My sun is Aquarius and my moon is Virgo. So,
oh my God, I see it.
You see it? Yeah. Very, very trustworthy, practical when it comes to emotions, that sort of thing.
Yeah. A fellow Aquarian.
Aquarian as well. Yes. Yeah.
That's why we're such good friends.
I know, that's true. Also, maybe just to note that we are recording this podcast when the moon is in Sagittarius.
Oh.
So there's lots of fire energy at the moment. And I guess I'm really thinking about what I'm going to do and what I'm planning for the next season.
Yeah. And we're going to bring some of that fire in this conversation, I think. I'm sensing. So did you ever have a nickname or do you still?
I did have a nickname. It was Georgie. Nobody calls me that anymore.
Should we bring it back?
I'm not sure, to be honest. It makes me turn red.
Well, yeah. That's very nice of you to share that.
Yeah, maybe that was a bit too much. But hey.
Hey, that's what we're here for. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Nigeria. I moved around, so I was in the north for a bit, and then most of the rest of the time that I was there, I was in Lagos.
And what kind of home did you grow up in? Was it a flat, a house?
Yeah, I mean, it was mostly a house. because I moved around, obviously the typology changed, but it was a house with a garden. So there was lots of nature around, but I guess the relationship to nature was quite different, or my relationship to nature was quite different back then than it is today.
And how many of you lived together in that house?
It was my parents and my sister and myself. We did have a dog at some point. Actually, we had lots of different animals. We had a dog, we had a goat at some point.
A goat? What?
Some chickens. They all kind of disappeared.
Oh my God, sinister. Circle of life, I guess.
Circle of life.
Wow, so this backyard garden was hosting all sorts of, living things.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I spent a lot of time outside, actually. Yeah.
Nice. And did you have a favorite toy as a child?
I did. I had like a little pink teddy bear that actually my mother still has now. So that was my favorite toy for a long time. I used to travel with it as well. It was quite big, bigger than me at some point. But yeah, that was my favorite toy as a child.
Does your toy have a name?
Yes, but I'm not going to share it.
Okay, it's private. I get it. Were there any foods that you refused to eat when you were young?
No, not really. Not really. No.
Yeah.
I wasn't really allowed not to eat.
I was just going to say.
It was kind of like, you know, you have to eat everything that comes your way.
Yeah, I definitely had a very similar upbringing.
Yeah.
Not allowed to be a picky eater.
Exactly. Which is great now.
Yeah.
You know, I'm down for anything.
Exactly. Yeah. And what was your favorite place to visit during your childhood?
Yeah, I was thinking about this one. It's for a long time, but I think it was my grandmother's closet. I love to take things out of it and dress up. So that was probably my favorite place.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was really kind of amazing because I would just turn into somebody else and build these kind of like fantasies. Yeah, so my grandmother's closet.
Yeah, perfect preparation for, you know, studying architecture.
Yeah,
like world building.
That's true, actually. I hadn't thought of that.
This is like, you know, therapy and podcasting.
I know, but well, you know what you're getting anyway. When you knew what you were getting, at least when you invited me.
So how would you describe what you do?
Yeah. So actually, I used to have a really long list. But over the past year, I kind of, you know, I tried to simplify how I describe my work. So I co-run a practice with my two partners, Summer and Paloma, called Material Cultures. And we predominantly work with bio-based materials, so natural materials, and we advocate for the use of these kind of regenerative materials in construction. And the work that we do, well, we've got different kind of arms to the practice. So we have research, design, and also we have an education platform that we is called MC Make. So the work that we do isn't really about what happens now, but mostly, or in the next few years, but about the kind of landscape legacies that we leave for the generation after next. So a lot of the work that we do is to kind of really move away from complicated building systems to those that are rooted in collective knowledge, and we do that in a kind of multi-scalar way. So yeah, that's kind of what I do at the moment.
And obviously this, like, I guess your current practice is something that's kind of evolved over time, but did you always know that this is somehow what you might end up doing?
No. But also, I don't like thinking of it as the end. I think, like, it's taken me a long time to get here, where I'm also just comfortable focusing all my energy on something and bringing all the kind of elements of my practice into that. And that's been really exciting. But it's in constant, like, metamorphosis. So I guess I'm excited to see, like, where it evolves in a few months, but also in a year. It's not very static, I think.
Well, yeah.
I know.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I've always felt like when you can see the rest of your career ahead of you and you know exactly what it's going to look like, it's probably the scariest moment. So it's much more exciting to make room for the unknown.
Yeah, exactly. And also to just kind of feed off everything that you come across and the bumps in the road, and I think all of these things really play a key role in how you shape your practice.
Definitely. So other than a phone or a laptop, what would you say are the tools that you work with?
I don't know. I thought about that one a lot because actually I used to draw a lot. I don't anymore, which is a bit of a shame. But I guess I've been trying more and more to work with my emotions as kind of a key part of my toolkit. There's also obviously speaking and writing and performing, making, and also organizing, I think, has been really interesting for me to think of that as a creative practice.
That's really interesting, I think, in terms of where you started with talking about drawing and then thinking of other ways in which you can, like, express yourself or think about, like, the complex work that you're engaging with or the situations you're engaging with. What is the space in which you work like?
Yeah, I mean, it is the office. It's also the construction site. It's also the garden, which I've been spending a lot more time in now. And it's also the classroom, which I'm spending less time in now. But they're all quite different. They're all a little bit messy, which feels very secure. I quite like being in a messy space and making sense of it all, or trying to make sense of it all. So yeah, lots of different spaces, but I think the common thread is, like, they're all a bit messy.
Which leaves room for, I guess, creative expression as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you walked into a space and it was, like, really well organized and sorted, then it's kind of not interesting.
It's also a bit daunting.
Yeah.
And is there a particular book that has had a significant impact on the way you approach your work?
Yeah, I did think about that question for a long time. I think it really depends, because it's there are some overarching themes, I guess, in the work. But I think I go through different kind of phases, and I'm the kind of person that I cannot read one book at a time. So I'm always reading like 5 books at a time. I never get to finish all of them. I'm always kind of I've been learning to just read the introduction these days.
Wow. speed reading.
Speed reading. But there is one book that's been really transformative in my practice, or in trying to understand my practice in relation to the people and the places that that we work with or that we work in. And this book is called Teaching to Transgress by Bell Hooks, which is actually a series of essays on teaching and emancipation and relationality. So I think a lot of our practice is about knowledge exchange. And so that book has been really key. Recently, I've been really into Vandana Shiva.
Yeah.
She's such a boss. And I've also been into The Toaster Project, which I discovered last year. Love that book. Such a great book. He takes a toaster and deconstructs it and looks at the complex networks and sites of extraction, production, and consumption. So it's actually quite incredible as a project. Lots of podcasts as well. I've been reading a lot about or listening a lot to people that are engaged in land work recently. So there's a really great podcast called Landscapes. Land for Abundance, that's a really good one as well. Yeah, I mean, I could go on, but that's kind of where I'm at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting to think about where we get our inspiration from, and like where some of these like texts, like the Bell Hooks one, that kind of we read at one point, but then continue to unfold in their impact on us over time.
It's really incredible. I make it a thing that, because I read it actually over a Christmas break a few years ago. So I make it a thing that every Christmas, that's one of the books that I flick through again to remind myself. It's such an incredible resource.
I think that's such a lovely ritual to reread that every year. I'm definitely going to borrow that and think about how I can reread things at the same point, just as a way to reflect on, I guess, maybe how much has changed or what new things I can get out of texts that have had a similar impact on me. So, if there was one technological device that you could invent, what would it be?
Yeah, I thought maybe time traveling, but then I'm not sure actually, because I don't really want to go back or like visit the future. I'm quite happy living the present, or at least I'm trying to be more present. So maybe not time traveling, but I don't really have an answer to this question.
Maybe it's something about thickening the present, or
ooh, that's good.
Or something that makes you more present.
That makes me more present. Yeah, I've been trying lots of different things out recently, the past few months, to try and be more present. So I've stopped drinking and I stopped smoking, and it's been actually quite amazing.
It's basically vice-free.
Yeah, but just to really be able to kind of like hang out and have a conversation with people. And not feel the need to be chasing something. I guess that was one of the things for this year, was to try and be more present.
Nice. I guess a lesser known fact about George is that he is my TikTok curator. So he helps me be more present in terms of what's going on in the world. By basically being my algorithm and selecting content for me to see.
That's a dangerous thing.
And yeah, so that's why I thought something like, I don't know, I feel like what's really nice about that is that rather than an algorithm that doesn't really know me, I have a friend who actually selects things that I might enjoy for me to not spend loads of time diving down TikTok holes, but instead get to see really nice things that you've handpicked.
And curated.
So maybe, I guess this is a really roundabout way of saying that maybe the answer isn't a technological device, but finding a way to replace the kind of anonymity of the algorithm or something with like care and friendship and things like that. I guess moving to the architecture section now, where do you live now?
I live in East London, yes. Yeah.
And is there one kind of hidden space you would recommend to visit in your neighborhood?
I don't know. I feel like there isn't really anything hidden in London anymore. But I do really enjoy Walthamstow Marshes, especially in spring or in the summer. So for foraging herbs, I've been doing a lot more like herbal things these days. So I really do enjoy Walthamstow Marshes. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's quite crazy. I live so close by to there and never really went there for many years until the pandemic, where I probably spent every evening, Saturday morning, walking around there. And it was quite an amazing time because you literally saw spring appear in front of you. Like from one day to the next, you could almost see flowers like unfurl. And like there was a pregnant swan that suddenly, like I just like tracked their whole pregnancy. it was like, I've never spent that much time in nature.
I mean, that's incredible.
And it's really incredible nature to be like within a city, but then you're also in this kind of very natural landscape. So yeah. I think it's really good.
It's quite unusual.
What is your favorite building currently in existence? And it doesn't have to be a building. It could also just be a space or...
I quite enjoy buildings that look outwards, that are part of a landscape and that feel really rooted, and that aren't really about expressions of power. So I guess I don't really have one building. I've visited a few buildings, let's say, over the year that are in really relatively remote parts of the UK or, let's say, Europe. And they've just been really... they've been really great. I'm not sure. I guess in a way for this question, I was thinking I'll describe the kind of buildings and spaces that I feel most comfortable in, rather than, because I think there's a lot of these buildings around.
And what is it about them that makes you feel more comfortable? Like you talked about them being like outward facing, but I guess it's quite hard to imagine an architecture that isn't about power.
They're a bit like, there are buildings that are very much like, very much part of the landscape. And the act of making the building is kind of terraforming in itself. And so there's something really incredibly beautiful about being in a space that is the ground and is the fields and is the woods and... and so, yeah, I think that's what makes it feel really... I feel really connected to some of these spaces in a way that I don't maybe in a building that's made of concrete or steel or glass.
Yeah. Are there any like specific ones that you would recommend?
You really want me to...
Maybe other people would like to go visit them and have experience these emotions.
No, because they're also really mundane. They're just like, you know, they kind of exist everywhere. And I think it's more about the moment that you're having rather than the building itself, I guess. But being very aware of the material culture that you are... see what I did there. That you are part of in that moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Sorry. That's not right. Really what you were after, but no, hey.
It's okay. it's about your answers. and if you could visit one piece of architecture that no longer exists, what would it be?
Probably Aleppo. So my heritage is Lebanese Syrian. I know very little about my Syrian heritage. But my parents always had these really incredible drawings of Aleppo at home. And I was always really curious about, or I always imagined that I would go visit one day. The one time that we had planned to make that visit, it didn't really work out. And so I never really got a chance to see it. So yeah, I guess maybe Aleppo is my answer to that question.
Yeah, those drawings sound amazing.
They really are. Actually, they're made of tiny, tiny, tiny Arabic calligraphy, the lines. So it's like all these poems and texts that make up this this map of the city or plan of the city.
That sounds incredible.
I'll send you a picture.
Yes, please. And if you could select one vehicle to travel around the world in, what would it be?
Walking. I love walking. So I think I would do that. I think it'd be physically impossible to do that. But if I had a magic power, maybe that would be...
It depends. You could definitely walk just about the amount of time it would take.
It depends how you do it, I suppose. Yeah. I was thinking more in one go. I really enjoy walking.
I do too. I think it's like a much nicer way to experience the city than most vehicular forms of transport.
Yeah, that's true. Agreed.
So obviously, as somebody whose practice is based in the kind of in material culture, this next question...
I hate the next question.
...is probably harder for you to answer because... You probably don't despise any materials outright, but what building material do you think is ugly and despise?
All materials come with a lot of baggage. And I think being able to unpack and understand the histories and culture around the formation of this material, I think to me is really interesting. I don't think I can pick one. I don't really despise anything or any material.
So do you think that any material could be workable if you unpacked its baggage?
No. We cannot continue to build with the same materials. Yeah, I think that's... The construction industry is a major contributor to... CO2 emissions. In fact, one of the biggest contributors in the world. And so there's lots of issues here of environmental justice, but actually also social justice that need to be addressed. So I think we need to start thinking about how, or we need to work with low carbon and bio-based materials. And I think that is an opportunity for us to think about new and innovative cultures and ways of existing in the world. Because I think there's also it's not as simple as saying we're just going to work with materials that are cultivated or that are grown, but to continue to grow these materials or to continue to grow these plants in using industrialized farming methods which are very violent. And so there's a lot to tackle in terms of also how we, our relationship to the land and how we manage it in order to think about, the built environment made from these materials.
Definitely.
In a nutshell.
Yeah, in a nutshell. No small. No small task. But yeah, I think it's interesting that if you drill down into kind of any material, there are probably problematic practices in how they're scaled for mass consumption or mass use. And yeah, maybe as a segue into the next question, I don't know, this thing about what you're saying about how some materials are grown also made me think back to when you were talking about foraging and I guess your kind of herbal focus this year. And I was wondering if that had an influence on your favorite restaurant in London right now.
I don't really eat out anymore. The pandemic changed me.
Wow. Oh my God. So you just make everything yourself.
Yeah.
You really are vice-free.
I don't make everything myself. Actually, I order a lot of food, which is really terrible. But I have tried to change my habits the last few months. Also trying to understand better what I'm eating and how that affects my body and my mood. And yeah, that's been a project for the last few months.
And how's that going?
It's all right. It's still trying to figure it out, but being more aware and conscious of the vessel that's carrying me around, I think has been very grounding. So yeah, so I have been a lot more careful about what I eat, but it hasn't been in restaurants, sadly. So I don't have a hot recommendation for you.
Sorry, listeners, but maybe we should all think about what we're putting inside ourselves more often. But I guess then when you're cooking at home or ordering in, what would you consider to be your perfect meal?
I think it's definitely Lebanese food.
That's yeah, great probably, answer.
That's probably what I order the most all the time.
And what was the last cultural event that you attended?
I haven't been out much lately. But I did go to the Biennale a few months ago, and I thought that was the Arsenale was really incredible.
The Venice Biennale.
Yes, yeah. The Venice Architecture Biennale. I try and answer this question. I was actually looking through my calendar to see like what have I done in the last 3 months. What show have I seen? Actually, it's really sad. I haven't seen anything in the last 3-4 months, except for the Venice Biennale.
Yeah. It was really amazing, this past year's Biennale. I think just seeing a totally different group of people take up that space and the types of work that was on display, made me very hopeful for a very different type of architecture, type of future that we might inhabit.
It also felt really empowering. I think, for me at least, the Arsenale was really incredible. Really incredible experience.
Yeah, and I just thought like all the different formats of work that started to emerge from like textiles and tapestries to these like really huge constructions that used materials in different ways and started to think of new forms of inhabitation. It was just...
And film, there was so much film. It was actually really incredible to immerse yourself in these kind of... in a completely different world through that medium.
Yeah. So, perfect segue now. If you could inhabit one film, what would it be?
That's a really tough question. I don't think I have an answer to that. Next question, Manije.
Okay, what is your favorite television show?
So my favorite, I love binge watching TV shows. That's like, yeah. And this is, I think, why I don't remember many of them. But right now, the one I have the most long-standing relationship with is this show called Couples Therapy.
Okay.
Have you heard of it?
No.
It's basically a show, Dr. Orna, who's really incredible, by the way, follows these couples through therapy. And you just kind of watch the conversations unfold. She's a psychoanalyst. And it's really great. It's really, really great. Yeah. So I would recommend people to watch that.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm like always on the lookout for good TV recommendations.
Another really great show that I've watched recently is Till Kingdom Come. So I think that's also on iPlayer. It's, Trump, Faith and Money.
Oof.
Links between evangelical Christian groups in America and the Israeli settlement program in the West Bank. Definitely worth watching.
Okay.
Really incredible documentary.
Yeah.
Very dark.
I will check it out. I'll check both of those out. Very different.
They are very different.
What was the first album that you bought?
Probably Michael Jackson.
Oh, wow.
Or the Spice Girls. I remember actually buying the Spice Girls album with the little booklet that came with it. Do you remember they made a little booklet of the Spice World?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was it. I was obsessed with both of them.
I think basically everyone I've spoken to in this podcast must be of the same generation, because I think my first album was also like Spice Girls one.
Yeah. I was really into dancing as well. So like I loved choreography. And yeah, so obviously Michael Jackson and the Spice Girls.
I hope you're going to do a demo for us after this.
Absolutely.
Shame
it's a podcast and it's not being filmed.
Well, I guess this is just like a way for people to realize all these like skills you have that maybe they don't know about. What's the best gig you've ever been to?
Erykah Badu.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I tried to remember what year it was, but I can't. It was probably when I was in, I don't know, second year at the AA or something. So a really long time ago. But it was by far one of the most amazing gigs I've been to. Actually, while speaking, I just remembered I went to a Prince gig once, which was also amazing. Definitely. Erykah Badu and Prince.
Yeah, I would have loved to have gone to Erykah Badu. I did go to a Prince concert, which was incredible.
Yeah, Prince was amazing, yeah.
And what would you say is your favorite album now?
So, we are recording this podcast in December of 2023. And so our Spotify Unwrapped recently came out. Or Wrapped.
Wrapped.
Not Unwrapped. Yeah. Although Unwrapped would be better.
Yeah. Spotify, I hope. Take note.
So Kali Uchis was my top artist. But I am the kind of person that does listen to albums. So probably my top album. Followed by Aya Nakamura. Love that album. So good. I heard that she wasn't great live. But sure. And Kelela. Yeah.
Nice.
Those are my top.
Nice grouping.
Top four. Yeah. What were your favorite albums this year on your Spotify Unwrapped?
On my Spotify Unwrapped, it's probably something really embarrassing and terrible. I can't actually remember. I'll tell you afterwards when I check on my phone.
That's all right, yeah.
I'm asking the questions. So.
I've heard you do that to some other guests of yours.
Okay, well, I guess you've mentioned so many different aspects of the kind of practice that you run. And the different spaces you occupy through that. And while doing so, you kind of engage with so many different complex and intersectional crises that we're currently facing, whether they're climate, race, gender, to name a few. And I was just curious as to what the resources are that you use in your work, especially as a practice that spans teaching, making, designing, advocacy, as a way to deal with this complexity.
Yeah. So I think central to our practice is land. So land is our main protagonist, and repairing our relationship to the land and how we understand it is really key. And so that's always central in, for me at least, in how I understand what's happening around the world. So at the moment, as we are witnessing the genocide that's taking place on Palestinian land in Gaza, I've been reading a lot about construction. Well, I've been reading a specific book called Stone Men by Andrew Ross, which looks at Palestinian stonemasons, their labor, the construction sector, and the building of the Israeli state. And so what's really interesting in this book is that it talks about how the central highlands of the West Bank have some of the best quality limestone in the world. And the business of stone quarrying, cutting and dressing is the territory's largest employer, but also generates the most revenue, supplying the construction sector or construction industry in Israel, as well as some other countries, Middle Eastern countries. So it's incredible because, like, for such a small population, Palestinians are actually one of the largest stone producers in the world. And with this kind of incredible, these incredible deposits on their land, it's also inevitable that Palestinian stonemasons are the region's best stonemasons because they've inherited this, these techniques and these tools from generation to generation. So what the book is doing is that it uses, it looks at the use of stone in the building of the Zionist project. And actually that there is such a heavy reliance on cheap Palestinian labor to build infrastructure and housing in the state of Israel. So it's a classic relationship between an imperial state and its reliance on land and cheap labor elsewhere. And this really benefits the Israeli state because it places really sharp constraints on Palestinian livelihood today and blocks a lot of their economic development in the West Bank and in Gaza to create those conditions for a dependent workforce with low wages. maybe to follow up a little bit on that, I'm still in the beginning of the book, so I'm just kind of giving you a brief...
The introduction.
Description. The introduction. I have gone past the introduction, though. What the book talks about as well is how in the early years, what's really interesting is, it looks at concrete and stone, especially in the beginning of the book. And it talks about how, like, in the early years of Zionist settlement, concrete was used as a signature of Israeli modernity. So it was used to cut out the kind of the Arab stonemasons and any reliance on their skills and labor. But also these building materials, so specifically in this case concrete, and this style was used or selected to make sure that these new Jewish settlements looked nothing like their Levantine surroundings. After the Nakba, the demolition of of lots of Palestinian villages, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know about, really reinforced this drive to use concrete and try and eradicate this legacy of Ottoman Palestine. But what's really interesting is actually after the annexation of the Old City in Jerusalem in 67, there was a real move from the Israeli state towards the heritage of the region, and as a way to kind of reinforce their presence and claim that territory. So the use of local stone became really popular and really important to give a kind of like vintage appearance that, you know, suggests this kind of long-standing connection with the land. And then you have these new settlements that started popping up on occupied land using the same limestone supply. So, and this is kind of where I'm at in the book, by the way. So that's where I'm going to... That's
a cliffhanger.
But this is also not to mention the kind of the drive to plant forests using fast-growing pines, European pines, over indigenous fauna, over a lot of ruins of these villages to conceal the evidence of the Nakba. So, yeah, so a book like this, for example, I think is really mind-opening to be able to connect actually a lot of the construction industry, architecture, extraction, materials, and also its relationship to land, to try and better understand how a lot of these struggles are interconnected and how actually the fight for Palestinian liberation is very much interconnected to a lot of the work that we are doing here.
Yeah, definitely.
On this land.
Yeah, definitely brings it back to materials, construction industry, but also architecture and the role that has to play in all of this.
Yes, absolutely. I think maybe I could add a few more resources to your listeners who might be interested. Some really great books at the moment that can help contextualize what's going on. Drinking the Sea at Gaza, Amira Haas, that's an incredible book. There's a classic by Rashid Khalidi called The 100-Year War on Palestine, which is also actually an audiobook on Spotify. And, well, to be honest, any Ilan Papi book. Currently, I'm flicking through The Biggest Prison on Earth, which is also quite incredible.
So on this topic, if there was one ill of the world that you could banish, what would it be?
Just one?
Yeah, it's tough. I think right now there's so many.
Violence, oppression.
Very interconnected.
They're interconnected, yes.
Okay, so to end our conversation, we have a quick fire round, so hopefully a bit easier. So morning person or night owl?
Morning.
I know that. What is your favorite season?
Spring.
Do you have a guilty pleasure?
Yes, watching The Real Housewives.
What is your most prized possession?
My KKW contour.
Do you want to expand on that for people who don't know the reference?
There's this really great TikTok.
Of course.
Where they ask Selena Gomez and Kim Kardashian what they can't live without. Selena Gomez says her family. Kim Kardashian says, my KKW contour. But if I have to explain it, then it's just, it's not as good.
Well, that's why you answered off the bat and then explained it. What was your first experience of the AA?
My interview. Sue Barr was in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I kind of love that.
I was really nervous.
We all were. Could you describe the AA in one word?
Chaotic.
Which brings us back nicely to the kind of messiness of all the different spaces you occupy.
Nice one.
And yes. Hopefully you'll be back to come to the AA before long.
Thank you so much.
Or rather, we found ways to bring you back through lectures, podcasts, and hopefully many more. Thank you so much, George. It's been great to get to chat with you.
Thanks, Manijay.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Air AA podcasts are developed, recorded, mixed and edited by the Architectural Association from our home on Bedford Square in central London. To find more episodes, view the show notes and explore other Air AA series, visit air.aaschool.ac.uk. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of the individuals involved in each episode. Opinions expressed by the hosts and guests can change at any time and are not representative of the AA.